And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 21st of June. The third Sunday in June is Father's Day. Father's Day is meant to honor all dads out there, and for us, that includes the furry, feathered, scaly, and spiky dads. Here are just a few amazing dads of the animal kingdom. Cassowary dads are wonderfully devoted fathers. After a female cassowary lays her eggs, she leaves to find another mate, and the male cassowary stays to take care of the chicks. The male will sit on the eggs for about 50 days, barely eating or drinking until they hatch. Once hatched, he will teach them how to forage for food, and the chicks stay with him for the next 9 to 18 months. Seahorses are one of the only species where the dad carries and delivers his babies. The dad can carry up to 2,000 babies in his pouch. The reproductive process begins when a male and a female seahorse do daily pre-dawn dances, intertwining their tails and swimming together. Eventually, they engage in a true courtship dance, which can last as long as 8 hours. It ends with the mom depositing her eggs into the dad's pouch, where the eggs are then fertilized and eventually hatch. The father cares for the young as they grow, regulating the water's salinity in the pouch to prepare them for life in the sea. When the tiny seahorses are ready to be born, the male undergoes muscular contractions to expel the young from the pouch. Red fox dads also get a shout out today. Once the mom gives birth to her pup, she stays with them, so it's the dad's job to bring food to the family, venturing out about every 6 hours. Red fox dads also teach the pups how to hunt and scavenge, sometimes even hiding food for them to find. He will also play ambush to teach the pups how to evade predators. And of course, we couldn't forget the emperor penguin dads. After laying an egg, the mom penguin transfers care to the dad. The dad then holds the egg on top of his feet to keep it warm until the egg hatches. After more than 60 days, the chick will hatch and the father will feed his chick crop milk, a thick liquid produced in his esophagus, until the mother returns. And then there are poison dart frog dads. Once fertilized eggs are deposited in a safe clearing, the dad watches over them for 14 to 18 days, ensuring the nesting ground is moist and well protected. Once the tadpoles emerge from the eggs, they hitch a ride on dad's back, and he brings them to a safe pool of water. He will then spend the next 8 to 12 weeks protecting them. Male gorillas lead their families and defend the females and offspring from any threats. They play a crucial role in the socialization of their offspring, helping them learn important skills. Sand grouse fathers come to the rescue of their thirsty young by undertaking a grueling commute of almost 125 miles daily to ensure their family has something to drink. Once at a pool, male sand grouses rock back and forth to soak their belly feathers, which hold water in hair-like coils. This isn't a luxury dip in a pool. Filling up can take 15 minutes, exposing them to predators like swooping falcons. At the end of a long day of travel, the dads can provide their young with a few precious tablespoons of water that the chicks suck from their father's belly feathers. And finally, the giant water bug dad carries over 100 eggs on his back. He stays near the water's surface to raise the eggs because they need to be exposed to air and moisture to survive. He performs rhythmic push-up-like movements underwater to circulate fresh water and oxygen over the eggs glued to his back. He keeps his young afloat for about 3 weeks until they hatch. And here's a poem for today. Only a Dad by Edgar Guest. Only a dad with a tired face coming home from the daily race, bringing little of gold or fame to show how well he has played the game, but glad in his heart that his own rejoice to see him come and to hear his voice. Only a dad with a brood of 4, one of 10 million men or more, plodding along in the daily strife, bearing the whips and the scorns of life, with never a whimper of pain or hate, for the sake of those who at home await. Only a dad, neither rich nor proud, merely one of the surging crowd, toiling, striving from day to day, facing whatever may come his way, silent whenever the harsh condemn, and bearing it all for the love of them. Only a dad, but he gives his all to smooth the way for his children small, doing with courage stern and grim the deeds that his father did for him. This is the line that for him I pen, only a dad, but the best of men. Only a Dad by Edgar Guest. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with a reminder to thank a dad today. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. Hello, everyone. About a week ago, I learned that Happy the Elephant was euthanized at the Bronx Zoo, where she had been held in captivity for 50 years or so. And so I thought today would be a good day to read a few stories about Happy the Elephant and her story, her life there in the zoo. So we're going to go ahead and start with a story that was published in The Guardian, actually a few years ago, in June of 2022, just to get acquainted with who Happy the Elephant was. The title of this article is Happy the Elephant is Not a Person, Says Court in Key U.S. Animal Rights Case. Activist group called for Happy's release from New York Zoo, calling her cognitively complex and autonomous. New York's top court has ruled that Happy, an elephant residing at the Bronx Zoo since the 1970s, cannot legally be considered a person in a closely watched case that tested the boundaries of applying human rights to animals. The case brought by an animal rights group argued Happy should be released from the zoo. The Non-Human Rights Project argued that Happy is an autonomous, cognitively complex elephant worthy of the right reserved in law for a person. The zoo and its supporters warned that a win for the Non-Human Rights Project could open the door to more legal actions on behalf of animals, including pets, farmed animals, and other species in zoos. The State Court of Appeals ruled on Tuesday 5-2 with a decision written by Chief Judge Janet DeFiore, echoing that point. Quote, "While no one disputes that elephants are intelligent beings deserving of proper care and compassion, a writ of habeas corpus was intended to protect the liberty of human beings and did not apply to a non-human animal like Happy," said DeFiore. Happy was born in the wild in Asia in the early 1970s, captured and brought as a one-year-old to the U.S. She arrived at the Bronx Zoo in 1977 with Grumpy, a fellow elephant who was fatally injured in a 2002 confrontation with two other elephants. The decision affirms a lower court ruling and means Happy will not be released to a more spacious sanctuary through a habeas corpus proceeding, which is a way for people to challenge illegal confinement. Extending that right to Happy to challenge her confinement at a zoo, quote, "would have an enormous destabilizing impact on modern society," end quote. And granting legal personhood in a case like this would affect how humans interact with animals, according to the majority decision. Indeed, followed to its logical conclusion, such a determination would call into question the very premises underlying pet ownership, the use of service animals, and the enlistment of animals in other forms of work, read the decision. Operators of the Bronx Zoo argued Happy is neither illegally imprisoned nor a person, but a well-cared-for elephant, respected as the magnificent creature she is. Two judges, Rowan Wilson and Jenny Rivera, wrote separate, sharply worded dissents, saying the fact that Happy is an animal does not prevent her from having legal rights. Rivera wrote that Happy was being held in an environment that is unnatural to her and that does not allow her to live her life. Her captivity is inherently unjust and inhumane. It is an affront to a civilized society, and every day she remains a captive, a spectacle for humans. We too are diminished, Rivera wrote. The ruling from New York's highest court cannot be appealed. The Non-Human Rights Project has failed to prevail in similar cases, including those involving a chimpanzee in upstate New York named Tommy. Stephen Wise, the group's founder, said he was pleased it managed to persuade some of the judges. He noted that the group had a similar case underway in California and more planned in other states and other countries. We will take a really close look at why we lost, and we'll try to make sure that that doesn't happen again to the extent that we can, he said. And now we'll read a couple of articles about Happy, written by the non-human rights organization themselves, in memory of Happy, torn from her natural habitat and herd in Thailand. When she was a baby, Happy was held captive in the Bronx Zoo for almost half a century. Happy was a female Asian elephant who was born in the wild in 1971. Captured as a baby, probably from Thailand in the early 1970s, along with six other calves, possibly from the same herd, according to the New York Times, she was imported to the U.S. and sold for $800. To the now-defunct Lion Country Safari in California, which named the calves after the dwarves in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. That same year, Sleepy died, and the corporation relocated Happy, Grumpy, Sneezy, Doc, Dopey, and Bashful to the still-operational Lion Country Safari in Florida. In 1977, the proprietors relocated all six elephants to circuses and zoos across the U.S. Happy and Grumpy were sent to the Bronx Zoo, managed by the Wildlife Conservation Society, formerly the New York Zoological Society, to be part of the newly created Wild Asia Monorail exhibit, then called the Bengali Express Monorail. There, in addition to displaying the elephants, the zoo, through the 1980s, compelled them to give rides, participate in tug-of-war contests, and perform tricks, as publicized by the New York Times, Fordham's Rams defeat Zoo's elephant in Bronx. And two-day party in celebration of elephants at Bronx Zoo and the New Yorker Elephant Extravaganza. Of Happy's demeanor and role in these purportedly educational shows, the elephant's low-key, no-nonsense trainer said, "Happy is a more physical elephant than anything I've ever seen. Most people, when they train elephants, cats, horses, or whatever, usually turn them loose and just watch them for hours. Then you can figure what trick to put on each elephant. Happy runs more, she moves more, she's rougher. That's why I put all the physical tricks on her. The hind leg stand, the sit-up." In 2002, the Bronx Zoo euthanized Grumpy after she was attacked by two other elephants held in captivity there. The zoo separated Happy from Patty and Maxine and introduced a younger female Asian elephant named Sammy to be Happy's companion. In 2005, Happy became the first elephant to pass the mirror self-recognition test, considered to be an indicator of self-awareness. That same year, the Bronx Zoo euthanized Sammy after she suffered kidney failure. Shortly after, the zoo announced it would end its captive elephant program once one or more of the elephants had died. If two die, officials say it would be inhumane to sustain an exhibit with a single elephant. From 2006 to the present, to protect Happy from the other elephants and with assurances from zoo director Jim Breheny that Happy is sufficiently happy where she is, the Bronx Zoo's loneliest elephant has lived alone without a true elephant companion in a rotating portion of the 1.15 acre exhibit. According to the New York Post, Happy spends most of her time indoors in a large holding facility lined with elephant cages, which are about twice the length of the animal's bodies. The public never sees this. In November of 2018, Maxine died, leaving Patty and Happy each alone in the exhibit. Happy died at the Bronx Zoo on May 26, 2026, at the age of 55. And here is the press release given by the Non-Human Rights Project, titled, "The Non-Human Rights Project Mourns the Passing of Happy, the History-Making Elephant at the Bronx Zoo." This was published May 28, 2026 in New York. From 2018 to 2022, Happy was a client of the NHRP, or the Non-Human Rights Project, in a groundbreaking court case that sought recognition of her right to liberty under New York's common law of habeas corpus and her release to an elephant sanctuary. Yale historian Jill Lepore called Happy's case the most important animal rights case of the 21st century. Statement from Christopher Berry, executive director of NHRP, is below. Happy made history. She opened courtroom doors and brought attention to legal rights for animals. However, while Happy's legal case marked a significant milestone, her personal story is one of enduring hardship and loss. She suffered from the moment she was taken from her family and natural home in Thailand to the day she was euthanized inside a barn at the Bronx Zoo. The Wildlife Conservation Society's Bronx Zoo kept Happy in captivity in conditions that did not meet her complex needs since 1977 and in solitary confinement for 20 years. As a result, she suffered significant physical and psychological harm. Happy lived at first with her companions, Grumpy and Sammy, but was kept in solitary confinement by the zoo after their deaths. She was forced to endure a near lifetime of chronic stress and trauma in the zoo's tiny, barren exhibit. Happy's suffering will not be in vain. Happy will always be remembered as the elephant who opened the courtroom doors for legal rights for animals. Two judges from the New York Court of Appeals issued powerful dissenting opinions in support of her right to liberty. Her case reached them after the world's first habeas corpus order on behalf of an elephant was issued in her favor, leading to historic hearings in which the Bronx Supreme Court wrote that Happy is more than just a legal thing or property. She is an intelligent, autonomous being who should be treated with respect and dignity, and who may be entitled to liberty. Happy's historic right to liberty hearings were the first of their kind for elephants, but they won't be the last. Happy also inspired the passage of the first animal rights legislation in the U.S. and the introduction of the first elephant captivity ban in New York City. The story of the injustice of her life will continue to be told. It will continue to touch the hearts of people around the world, including judges and elected officials, with the courage to recognize that animals like Happy have legal rights and that there is no justification for taking away their freedom. The Bronx Zoo and the Wildlife Conservation Society failed Happy, but they can still choose to do the right thing for the one remaining elephant at the Bronx Zoo, Patty. 20 years ago, the Wildlife Conservation Society pledged to permanently close its elephant exhibit at the Bronx Zoo should only a single elephant remain. That day has come. They should honor this commitment and arrange for Patty's release to an accredited elephant sanctuary. Additionally, the New York City Council should pass Intro 590, an elephant captivity ban introduced by council member Shahana Hanif, so no elephant suffers in New York City ever again. As New York Court of Appeals Chief Judge Rowan Wilson wrote in his dissent in Happy's case, "We should recognize Happy's right to petition for her liberty, not just because she is a wild animal who is not meant to be caged and displayed, but because the rights we confer on others define who we are as a society." About the Non-Human Rights Project. The Non-Human Rights Project is the only organization in the United States founded to secure fundamental legal rights for animals, bringing groundbreaking litigation that seeks to ensure that the law effectively protects them from harm. And Animal Defenders International wrote, "No happy ending for Bronx Zoo elephant. Half a century of unhappiness. We are saddened to learn of the death of Happy, a 55-year-old Asian elephant who spent almost her entire life in captivity at the Bronx Zoo. She was torn from her home at only a year old and never again knew the freedom that wild elephants experience. She endured 50 years of the suffering and distress that captivity inflicts on intelligent beings. Despite immense public outcry and a court case filed on her behalf arguing for her rights of personhood and liberty, she remained at the zoo until her dying day. She leaves behind Patty, a 57-year-old Asian elephant. Don't let Patty be yet another tragic failure to do right by elephants after years of suffering. The Bronx Zoo has disregarded the many voices advocating for these elephants and what is in their physical and psychological best interests for far too long. It might be too late for Happy, but Patty can still be given autonomy, space, and peace by being sent to a sanctuary. If you would like to take action for Patty, there is a phone number here that goes to the Bronx Zoo, 718-220-5100. One more time, that's 718-220-5100 to take action for Patty. And a few days ago, on June 8th, it was International Day of Action for Elephants in Zoos. Elephants should not be kept in zoos because captive environments inherently cannot meet their complex physical and psychological needs. Confinement leads to shortened lifespans, deadly chronic health issues, and psychological distress, making a life in captivity incompatible with their wild nature. In the wild, elephants walk up to 30 to 40 miles a day. Zoo enclosures, even at accredited facilities, are drastically smaller, which frequently leads to obesity, crippling arthritis, and fatal foot diseases. Elephants are highly social, matriarchal animals who live in extended family herds. Captivity disrupts these natural bonds, resulting in severe emotional distress. Lack of stimulation and space leads to zoocosis, characterized by neurotic, repetitive behaviors like pacing, head bobbing, and swaying. Zoos are not legitimate conservation programs that return animals to the wild or protect their habitats. Critics argue that captive breeding exists largely to sustain exhibit populations rather than preserve wild habitats. Many animal welfare organizations, such as Born Free, advocate for phasing out elephant exhibits in traditional zoos in favor of transferring them to massive natural habitat sanctuaries. So let's continue to talk about this idea of animals who are used for human entertainment. It's important to know that zookeepers as well as circus workers give animals antidepressants, tranquilizers, or antipsychotic drugs to try to conceal the animal's distress. Zoos would have you believe that they are all that stand between many of the species they house and extinction. But animals are almost never released from zoos, and those who are rarely fare well, since being reared in captivity leaves them ill-prepared to cope with life in the wild. Zoos dispose of surplus animals either by killing them or selling them to unethical exotic animal dealers. Zoos are hardly educational. The caged, lonely animals they house are so far removed from their natural context that they have little opportunity to follow their instincts. The only thing to be learned at these sad facilities is how animals who want to be free act when they are confined. At the end of the day, zoos are businesses geared towards entertainment, not educational establishments. All they teach people is that it is acceptable to interfere with animals and keep them locked up in captivity. All of this talk about Happy the elephant got me thinking about an elephant from longer ago, a 19th century African elephant who was very famous in our country, named Jumbo. The name Jumbo is derived from a Swahili word meaning hello or chief. The elephant's name spawned the common word jumbo, meaning large in size. Examples of his lexical impact are phrases like jumbo jet, jumbo shrimp, jumbo eggs, and jumbotron. Jumbo was born in 1860 in Sudan, and after his mother was killed by poachers, the infant Jumbo was captured by Sudanese elephant poacher Tahir Sharif and German big game poacher Johann Schmidt. The calf was sold to Lorenzo Casanova, an Italian animal dealer and explorer, who in turn sold Jumbo to Gottlieb Kreutzberg's Menagerie Kreutzberg in Germany. Soon after, the elephant was imported to France and kept in the Paris Zoo Jardin des Plantes. In 1865, he was transferred to the London Zoo. In the following years, Jumbo became a crowd favorite due to his size and would give rides to children on his back, including those of Queen Victoria. While in London, Jumbo broke both tusks, and when they regrew, he ground them down against the stonework of his enclosure. In 1882, Abraham Bartlett, superintendent of the London Zoo, sparked national controversy with his decision to sell Jumbo to the American entertainer Phineas T. Barnum of the Barnum and Bailey Circus for £2,000, or $10,000. This decision came as a result of concerns surrounding Jumbo's growing aggression and potential to cause a public disaster. The sale of Jumbo, however, sent the citizens of London into a panic because they viewed the transaction as an enormous loss for the British Empire. 100,000 school children wrote to Queen Victoria begging her not to sell the elephant. Matthew Scott, Jumbo's keeper in London and whose 1885 autobiography details his life with Jumbo, elected to go with him to the United States. In New York, Barnum exhibited Jumbo at Madison Square Garden, earning enough in 3 weeks from the enormous crowds to recoup the money he spent to buy the animal. In the 31-week season, the circus earned $1.75 million, largely due to its star attraction, Jumbo. Jumbo died at a railway yard in St. Thomas, Ontario, Canada, on September 15, 1885. In those days, the circus crisscrossed North America by train. St. Thomas was considered to be an ideal location for a circus because many rail lines converged there. Jumbo and the other animals had finished their performances that night, and as they were being led to their boxcar, a train came down the track. Jumbo was hit and mortally wounded, dying within minutes. Barnum told the story that Tom Thumb, a young circus elephant, was walking on the railroad tracks, and Jumbo was attempting to lead him to safety. Barnum claimed that the locomotive was going to hit and kill Tom Thumb, but Jumbo stepped in, saving Tom Thumb, being hit and killed himself in the process, and other witnesses supported Barnum's account. According to newspapers, the freight train hit Jumbo directly, killing him, while Tom Thumb suffered a broken leg. Even after death, Jumbo was not left alone. Ever the showman, Barnum had portions of his body separated to display in multiple sites, attracting curious spectators. After touring with Barnum's circus, the skeleton was donated to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, where it remains. The elephant's heart was sold to Bert Green Wilder of Cornell University and had been lost by the 1940s. Jumbo's hide was stuffed, and the mounted specimen traveled with Barnum's circus for 2 years. Barnum eventually donated the stuffed Jumbo to Tufts University, where it was displayed at P.T. Barnum Hall there for many years. Jumbo's taxidermied tail resides in the holdings of the Tufts Archival Research Center. The elephant is the official Tufts University athletic mascot. Jumbo was an innocent whose entire life was commodified into a series of exploitations. Today, we remember and honor Jumbo and Happy and all of their brothers and sisters in captivity. There's a poem by Rudyard Kipling called The Elephant that seems fitting at this point. The elephant. I will remember what I was. I am sick of rope and chain. I will remember my old strength and all my forest affairs. I will not sell my back to man for a bundle of sugarcane. I will go out to my own kind and the wood folk in their lairs. I will go out until the day, until the morning break, out to the wind's untainted kiss, the water's clean caress. I will forget my ankle ring and snap my picket stake. I will revisit my lost loves and playmates masterless. Tumai of the Elephants. The Elephant by Rudyard Kipling. This is a reminder that all animals are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Here's a piece written by PETA entitled Animals Used for Entertainment. Animals aren't actors, spectacles to imprison and gawk at, or circus clowns. Yet thousands of elephants, bears, apes, and others are forced to perform silly, difficult tricks under the threat of physical punishment. Carted across the country in cramped, stuffy semi-truck trailers, kept chained or caged in barren, filthy enclosures, and regularly separated from their families and friends, all for the sake of our entertainment. Many of them are even forced to perform until the day they die. PETA is determined to get animals out of the entertainment business. Our dedicated staff members work full-time exposing and ending animal abuse in the entertainment industry, and their work is paying off. Consider the demise of Ringling Brothers Circus, for example. In addition to ending circus cruelty, these staff members work with officials to overhaul horse racing rules nationwide, spearhead hard-hitting undercover investigations, and public campaigns that are crucial in turning public opinion against animal exploiting attractions, persuade travel companies to stop selling tickets to SeaWorld and other cruel operations, persuade companies like Coca-Cola to stop sponsoring abusive forms of entertainment, such as the deadly Iditarod, persuade entertainment executives not to use animals in movies or TV, and to use motion capture technology instead, chip away at abusive animal exhibitors like the Mobile Zoo and facilitate the transfer of neglected animals from roadside zoos, traveling menageries, and other seedy facilities to reputable sanctuaries. Circus acts featuring only willing human performers, TV shows and films using CGI animals and interactive virtual reality aquariums are captivating audiences. Meanwhile, archaic, cruel animal acts are on the decline. Thanks in part to PETA's work, public opposition to horse racing cruelty, marine parks, dog sledding, elephant rides, cockfighting, petting zoos, horse-drawn carriage rides, bullfighting, sport fishing, trophy hunting, rodeos, traveling animal acts, roadside zoos, and safari parks has never been stronger. Animal-free forms of entertainment teach audience members about conservation, something places that imprison and enslave animals, such as SeaWorld, only pretend to do. What's wrong with circuses? And is SeaWorld really that bad? Animals don't like to be put on shows that are used and abused for the sake of human entertainment to force bears, elephants, tigers, and others in circuses to perform confusing and physically demanding tricks. Trainers use bull hooks, whips, tight collars, muzzles, electric prods, and other painful tools of the trade. Frustrated by years of beatings and confinement, many of them snap. Countless animals, trainers, and members of the public have been injured and even killed. Animals held captive at marine parks or in aquariums don't fare much better. In captivity, orcas and other dolphins swim in endless circles in tanks that to them are the equivalent of bathtubs, and they're denied the opportunity to engage in almost any natural behavior. Instead, some are forced to perform meaningless tricks. Most die far short of their natural life expectancy. The dead bodies of tigers at pseudo-sanctuaries, bears confined to cages and pits, and bulls forced to buck and fight are stacking up too. There's only one acceptable thing to do with animals exploited for entertainment: retire them to reputable sanctuaries or loving homes. PETA has helped facilitate such transfers, as in the case of Nosy the elephant. We campaigned for her freedom from the circus for years, and now she's loving her sanctuary home in Tennessee. Charlie, a thoroughbred horse on the brink of a fatal breakdown, was also rescued by PETA. He now spends his days grazing on grass in a large pasture with his guardian, a longtime PETA supporter and friend. And then there was Tregembo Animal Park in North Carolina, which two local animal advocates represented by PETA's lawyers successfully sued, allowing us to transfer bears Ben and Bogey to a sprawling Colorado sanctuary. Between 2013 and 2018, PETA saved more than 70 bears from cramped pens and concrete hells, helping to transfer them to true sanctuaries where they can finally play, climb, have friends, and raise their families. Some of our rescues have even helped shut down roadside zoos. How you can help animals forced to perform or fight. These life-changing victories wouldn't be possible without the help of our members and supporters. Each of us can help prevent suffering and deaths by refusing to buy a ticket to watch broken animals languish in captivity or perform stupid tricks. Demanding that government agencies like the U.S. Department of Agriculture do their jobs, and urging companies to not do business with animal exploiting operations. With the help of our members and supporters, PETA works globally to expose and end the use of animals in entertainment. Some of our efforts include the following: conducting groundbreaking undercover investigations and colorful advocacy campaigns to inform the public. Persuading government agencies to hold circuses, roadside zoos, marine parks, and other operations accountable when they apparently violate the law. Encouraging companies to refuse to promote or sponsor elephant rides, tiger encounters, swim with dolphins excursions, the Iditarod, or other animal attractions. Advocating for pro-animal legislation. Organizing spirited protests outside businesses and company headquarters to help prevent new animal exploiting attractions from opening. Calling on roadside zoos and traveling menageries to do the right thing by retiring animals to reputable sanctuaries. Persuading county and state fairs to exclude animals from their attractions. This multifaceted approach yields scores of victories for animals imprisoned and used by the entertainment industry around the world. Who are elephants? Let's learn a little bit about who elephants are. There are three species of elephants: African savanna, African forest, and the Asian elephant. The ears of African elephants are much larger than their Asian cousins. There's also a trunk difference. African elephants have two so-called fingers at the tip of their trunks, whereas Asian elephants have one. The African savanna elephant is the world's largest land animal, with bull elephants standing up to 3 meters high and weighing up to 6,000 kilograms. Males only reach their full size at 35 to 40 years old. That's well over half their lifespan as wild elephants, because wild elephants can live for up to 60 to 70 years. Elephants have around 150,000 muscle units in their trunks. Their trunks are perhaps the most sensitive organ found in any mammal. They use their trunks to suck up water to drink. The trunk can contain up to 8 liters of water. They also use their trunks as a snorkel when swimming. Elephant tusks are actually enlarged incisor teeth, which first appear when elephants are around 2 years old. Tusks continue growing throughout their lives. Tusks are used to pry bark off trees or dig up roots, or as a defense when fighting. An elephant's skin is 2.5 centimeters thick. The folds and wrinkles in their skin can retain up to 10 times more water than flat skin does, which helps to keep them cool. They protect themselves from sunburn by taking regular dust and mud baths. Elephants are herbivorous and eat grasses, leaves, shrubs, fruits, and roots. When it's particularly dry, elephants will eat more woody parts of trees and shrubs like twigs, branches, and barks. Elephants communicate in a variety of ways, including sounds like trumpet calls, some of which are too low for people to hear, body language and touch, and scent. The Guardian published the article titled, "Elephants Call Each Other by Name," study finds. Researchers used an artificial intelligence algorithm to analyze calls by two herds of African savanna elephants in Kenya. Elephants call out to each other using individual names that they invent for their fellow pachyderms. The research not only shows that elephants use specific vocalizations for each individual, but that they recognize and react to a call addressed to them while ignoring those addressed to others. Remarkably, elephants generate and respond to mini earthquakes to transfer information between each other using vocalizations known as rumbles that concurrently generate an acoustic vibration, which they detect through their bones. The elephant's temporal lobe, the area of the brain associated with memory, is larger and denser than that of humans. Elephants really never forget. Elephants also bury their dead and pay tribute to the bodies and to the bones. Scientists have observed that elephants feel empathy. They toss dust upon the wounds of fellow elephants. They help others climb out of mud and holes. They even have been seen plucking tranquilizing darts from one another with their trunks. Researchers have observed elephants trying to help dying friends, lifting them with tusks and trunks, crying out in distress. Around 90% of African elephants have been wiped out in the past century, largely due to the ivory trade. It is estimated that every day, 100 African elephants are killed by poachers. Asian elephants are also under threat, having declined by at least 50% in the last 3 generations. Elephants are running out of space and time. We have to work together to prevent senseless poaching and the trafficking of ivory, and establish protected natural sanctuaries in which elephants and other wildlife can thrive before it's too late and they're gone. And here is a retelling of a fun Indian parable. Here it's retold by John Godfrey Sachs. It's titled, "The Blind Men and the Elephant." It was 6 men of Indostan to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant and, happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling the tusk, cried, "Ho, what have we here, so very round and smooth and sharp? To me 'tis very clear, this wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly he up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and fell about the knee. "What most the wondrous beast is like is very plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough, the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "Even the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can. This marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no sooner had begun about the beast to grope than, seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indistan disputed loud and long, each in his own opinion exceeding stiff and strong. Though each was partly in the right, they all were in the wrong. The Blind Men and the Elephant by John Godfrey Sachs. This is a reminder that the elephant still has much to teach us. And now for something completely different. Let's finish out today's show by starting a short little book. This book is titled "Don't Drink Your Milk: Frightening Medical Facts About the World's Most Overrated Nutrient." This book was written by Frank A. Oski, MD. The back of the book says, "Caution: milk can be harmful to your health. If you drink milk, you must read this." The late Frank Oski, MD, was director of pediatrics, Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and physician in chief, Johns Hopkins Children's Center. The first chapter is titled "Milk is Natural." When my youngest daughter was in the second grade, she came home one afternoon perplexed and teary-eyed. She had failed to get a perfect grade on her daily reading quiz. We reviewed the questions together. The quiz contained three questions designed to test reading comprehension and requiring simple yes and no answers. Here were the test questions. Do you think a rabbit could make a mitten? Can a fish hop like a rabbit? Should all boys and girls have milk? To all three, she had answered no. The teacher had found her answer to the one about milk unacceptable and graded it as incorrect. Yet my daughter had been taught at home that people don't need cow's milk, and in fact, it is actually harmful to many people's health. This information came as a surprise to her teacher, who I suspect still believes I'm living on the lunatic fringe of society. Being against cow's milk is equated with being un-American. It is easy to understand this view, which is inspired mainly by the advertising practices and political pressure of the American dairy industry. For many of us, our earliest memories of childhood include our mother's plea, "Hurry up and finish your milk." We have all been exposed to subtle endorsements of cow's milk, like that reading test given to my daughter and her fellow second graders, and we can all recite the industry's familiar slogans and jingles. Got milk? Milk is a natural. Milk is the perfect food. Everybody needs milk. And you've probably seen the bumper sticker, "Milk drinkers make better lovers." This advertising has been remarkably successful. $1 of every $7 spent for food in the United States goes for the purchase of milk and milk products. Each person in this country consumes, on average, 375 pounds of dairy products each year. These items make up the second largest food expense, ranking behind only the combined expenses for meat, fish, poultry, and eggs. 18 million cows in the United States tell us by their rotund reality, the dairy industry is big business. This agglomerate carries solid political punch. From it, one of every seven members of Congress receives support for re-election. Milk producers' cooperatives exert legislative pressures to artificially maintain high prices for milk. They benefit from many state and federal laws and tax their farmer members as much as 5 cents per 100 pounds of milk produced to continue all forms of milk promotion. Thomas V. Angett, former chair of the National Dairy Council, took pride in telling members, milk sales stayed up during the recent recession, even in areas of high unemployment, such as Detroit, thanks to the effective milk promotion efforts of the industry. But at last, a growing number of physicians, private citizens, and even the Federal Trade Commission are beginning to re-examine these long-standing and deeply ingrained beliefs in the virtue of cow's milk. Even Richard Nixon and John Connolly came to realize that cow's milk may not be good for you. The fact is that drinking cow's milk has been linked to iron deficiency anemia in infants and children. It has been named as the cause of cramps and diarrhea in much of the world's population, and the cause of multiple forms of allergy as well. And the possibility has been raised that it may play a central role in the origins of atherosclerosis and heart attacks. Among physicians, so much concern has been voiced about the potential hazards of cow's milk that the Committee on Nutrition of the prestigious American Academy of Pediatrics, the institutional voice of practicing pediatricians, released a report titled, Should Milk Drinking by Children Be Discouraged? Although the Academy's answer to this question has, as of this writing, been a qualified maybe, the fact that the question was raised at all is testimony to the growing concern about this product, which for so long was viewed as sacred as the proverbial goodness of mother and apple pie. Most lay people are not aware that the milk of mammalian species varies considerably in its composition. For example, the milk of goats, elephants, cows, camels, yaks, wolves, and walruses show marked differences, one from the other, in their content of fats, proteins, sugar, and minerals. Each was designed to provide optimum nutrition to the young of the respective species. Each is different from human milk. In general, most animals are exclusively breastfed until they have tripled their birth weight, which in human infants occurs around the age of 1 year. In no mammalian species, except for the human and the domestic cat, is milk consumption continued after the weaning period. Calves thrive on cow's milk. Cow's milk is for calves. In many other parts of the world, most particularly in East Asia, Africa, and South America, people regard cow's milk as unfit for consumption by adult human beings. If we are to judge by general mammalian standards, their tastes are not peculiar. Americans and Europeans' tastes are. Despite our notions, it is not the Chinese and Africans who differ most markedly from the norms of nature. Cow's milk, like all milks, contains three basic ingredients: sugar, fat, and protein. These three substances are suspended in water that also contains a variety of minerals and vitamins. Each of the three basic ingredients of cow's milk has now come under scrutiny as a cause of problems in human nutrition. In April 1974, the Federal Trade Commission issued a proposed complaint against the California Milk Producers Advisory Board and their advertising agency. In this complaint, they cited the slogan, "Everybody needs milk," as representing false, misleading, and deceptive advertising. The Federal Trade Commission judged that enthusiastic testimonials by celebrities, such as Olympic swimmer Mark Spitz, baseball pitcher Vita Blue, dancer Ray Bolger, columnist Abigail Van Buren, and singer Florence Henderson conveyed an inaccurate picture of the value of milk as a food. Quickly, the dairymen changed their approach and came up with a new slogan, "Milk has something for everybody." This is certainly technically correct. The question you must ask yourself before you drink that next glass of milk, however, is, do you really want that something? The second chapter, which we will just be able to start today, is titled Paying Premium for a Quart of Intestinal Gas. Mrs. Edwards was 40 years old when her only son was sent to Vietnam. Mrs. Edwards was a widow. Her husband, a police officer, had been killed in a gun battle with a gang of thieves. She worried that her son, age 19, might also die from gunfire. As the intensity of the war in Vietnam increased and her son's letters became more infrequent, she began to experience vague and recurrent pains in her upper abdomen. After a while, the pains awakened her at night. Sharpening, the pains were associated with tenderness to the touch in an area midway between her breastbone and her navel. Finally, this heartburn forced her to see her family physician. The doctor, after listening to Mrs. Edwards' story, suspected that she had developed an ulcer and sent her to a local hospital for some x-rays of her stomach and upper gastrointestinal tract. The studies revealed that Mrs. Edwards did in fact have a duodenal ulcer. The doctor prescribed some medication and also instructed Mrs. Edwards to drink large quantities of milk. She was to drink a glass between breakfast and lunch, a glass with lunch, a glass in the mid-afternoon, another with dinner, and a final glass at bedtime. She followed this schedule carefully, and within a matter of several weeks, her stomach pains vanished. But now Mrs. Edwards was experiencing another form of discomfort. Constantly bloated, she had intermittent cramps in her lower abdomen, past watery stools, and was continually embarrassed by the expulsion of large volumes of gas by rectum. Mrs. Edwards returned to her doctor. He repeated the x-ray studies of her stomach and upper gastrointestinal tract. Her ulcer had been cured. The doctor told Mrs. Edwards that her present complaints were a sign of an irritable colon brought on by continued concern about her son, and that if they persisted, she would have to see a psychiatrist. He urged her to continue taking her medication and following her diet to prevent a recurrence of the ulcer. By chance, Mrs. Edwards discussed her problem with a friend who had experienced the same problems of lower abdominal cramps, bloating, and gas. Her friend's doctor had explained that she had lactose intolerance and that the symptoms were caused by the drinking of milk. When Mrs. Edwards heard this, she decided that rather than go to a psychiatrist, she would stop drinking milk. It worked. Overnight, her symptoms disappeared. I think we'll go ahead and stop there for today, but we're going to continue on with Don't Drink Your Milk next time. We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.